Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Good evening, everyone. We begin the readout tonight with good trouble in the fight against voter suppression. Just days after the one-year anniversary of the death of the late, great John Lewis, a civil rights icon who spent his entire life fighting for human and civil rights, beaten as a young man marching for the rights of Black Americans across the South and across the country to vote and have that vote counted. Now, Lewis's home state, Georgia, is at the epicenter of the Republican assault on voting rights, home to one of the nation's most draconian voter suppression laws, implemented after Black and brown voters in Georgia gave Joe Biden the presidency and Democrats control of the United States Senate. A lot of people were hailing Lewis on this anniversary, including Arizona conservative Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema, who got quite a bit of blowback for calling Lewis her dear friend and, quote, personal hero. Since Sinema and West Virginia's Joe Manchin stand in opposition to ending the legislative filibuster, guaranteeing that voting rights legislation will fail in the face of Republican obstruction. Meanwhile, other Democrats were making good trouble in Atlanta today. For the first time in 20 years, the Senate Rules Committee held a field hearing, starting with impassioned remarks from Georgia Senator, the Reverend Raphael Warnock, John Lewis's pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church.
Sadly, what we're seeing in Georgia is an attempt to deny certain people the ability to have their voices heard in our democracy. As I've said time and time again, some people don't want some people to vote. Congress must take action on voting rights. And we have no time to spare. There is nothing more important for us to do this Congress. We Americans live in a great house that democracy built. And right now, that house is on fire.
Not a single Republican senator participated in today's field hearing. Minority Leader McConnell poked his head out of his shell long enough, however, to call the proceeding a, quote, silly stunt. On Sunday, Rules Committee Chairwoman Amy Klobuchar held a roundtable with Stacey Abrams, hearing from voters about obstacles to the ballot. Speaking to NBC's Garrett Hake before today's hearing, Klobuchar took aim at Republicans' ongoing complicity with the big lie.
I believe this is an even bigger deal than just party versus party. This is literally a quest to save our democracy, because once you start disenfranchising people, then people lose faith.
For her part, Stacey Abrams' voting rights organization, Fair Fight Action, is launching version 2.0 of its Hot Call Summer campaign, asking supporters to call their senators every day until they take action to pass the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Restoration Act. And joining me now is Stacey Abrams, founder of Fair Fight Action and author of Our Time Is Now, which is available now in paperback. And Stacey, it's always great to talk with you. Let's talk about what the field hearing that took place today means in practical terms.
Well, first and foremost, it's an opportunity to once again set the record straight. There's been an attempt by opponents of S1 to be, you know, either intentionally reductive or intentionally obtuse. This is not a question of a simple change to the law. This is about a series of laws being passed across the country, starting in Georgia, to reduce access to the right to vote for inconvenient voters, voters of color, young people, disabled voters, elderly voters, poor voters, but largely targeting communities of color that outperformed in the 2020 and 2021 runoffs here in Georgia.
And, you know, everyone seems to understand that, we think, in the Democratic Party, which is the party that, you know, that is the preferred choice of the majority of voters of color. And yet, despite the fact that you have fellow Democratic senators in Georgia doing a field hearing today, you know, Kyrsten Sinema is tweeting about how much she loves and respects John Lewis. I mean, I will echo Michael Harriet, who said, well, it's a sure funny way of showing that he's your hero by not reflecting any of the things that he believes in. And Bishop Barber said the same thing, called it shameful. people to claim you honor John Lewis while you block the work that he's trying to do. And Harriet also pointed out that it was difficult to find in Googling Ms. Kyrsten Sinema's background any note of her having revered John Lewis. What do you make of the Democrats who love to quote John Lewis the way people quote Dr. King, but are literally doing absolutely nothing because S1 ain't going to pass as long as Sinema and Manchin refuse to change the filibuster?
Well, I think that we have to recognize there are two layers to this challenge. The first layer and the successful layer was getting 50 Democratic senators on the record supporting a version of the For the People Act that can affect these laws and can save our democracy. The second step then is what do we do mechanically to make it happen? I believe that the first step is either a carve out to the filibuster or a reduction in the threshold or returning it to its original form, which is the talking filibuster. And so I do call on every single senator, both those who have declared out loud that they oppose that they want to support the filibuster, and those who are being quiet about it, that this is a time for action. That yes, we appreciate your reverence for and your respect for John Lewis and the work of saving democracy, but now is the urgent time for action. What happened in Texas, what's happening right now, what will happen in Ohio, what will happen in North Carolina, what will happen in Pennsylvania is not endemic to the South. It is endemic to authoritarians who do not want to see inconvenient voters cast their ballots and speak their minds. And that has to be the call to arms. This is not simply about one moment. This is about the foundations of our democracy, and they are in peril. And it's time now for every single member of the U.S. Senate, Democrats and Republicans and independents, to declare their allegiance to our democracy as opposed to their parties.
And thank you for pointing that out. The only difference between the South in the South is that it's where half of African Americans are and where there are big concentrations of black voters and that it's controlled by Republicans for the most part. For people who want to participate in Hot Call Summer, I've had this question asked to me a lot. I think it's really important to do it. Explain to them, because the John Lewis Act and the S1 are very different things. Can you just sort of lay out for us what are the differences? What should people understand about how these two bills are different?
So first of all, we want to thank the 40,000 calls that were made during the first phase of Hot Call Summer. And we encourage folks to dial again, 888-453-3211. But here's the difference. The John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act is designed to say that for new bills that would be proposed after its passage, those bills cannot take effect without being pre-cleared by the Justice Department if you are in one of the states that's covered by the Voting Rights Advancement Act. That's an important piece. But before we get there, we've got to undo all the bad that's already been done. So the Voting Rights Advancement Act will stop new bad from happening once it passes. But we still have to clean up all of the terrible bills, the 28 bills that have already passed and any that pass in the interim. And that's what the For the People Act does. It says that no matter where you live in the United States, if you live in Georgia, which has good laws but terrible rules and has now new laws that negate the effectiveness of our good rules, or you live in a state that's been allowed to suppress your vote for years, that we all have a level playing field. So we want the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act to stop new bad, but we've got to clean up the old bad. We've got to clean up the current attack on our votes by making certain we pass the For the People Act. And that means Hot Call Summer. That means calling every U.S. senator, no matter their party, because they work for you and they need to hear from you.
That is so important.
453-3211.
Thank you. I didn't mean to interrupt the phone number. I'm going to let you get the phone number again before we go, because that is the key thing, is that people need to understand that these are two very separate things, but that John Lewis is sort of retroactive. It's proactive for the future, but it wouldn't actually, because there does feel like, and I don't know if maybe this is just my perception, that there is a bit of a bait and switchish kind of thing going on. For a lot of Democrats, they're worried that Democrats are going to go ahead and use, the sort of simple 50 vote to push through things that are long held desires of Democrats, which are all good things, you know, passing things like the child tax credit and infrastructure that gives child care and changing Medicare and doing all of these really great things that are going to help a lot of people. But in the meantime, they're just going to give the promise of a future John Lewis Act as the thing they do for voting rights and leave S1 behind. Are you concerned that in the whole bargain that's happening in Washington, the John Lewis Act gets to be a future thing that they'll do down the road, maybe if, Manchin will let them, but that S1, which is the bill, as you said, that actually fixes the bad laws, gets left on the table?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that the first 300 pages of the For the People Act were written by John Lewis. And so the fact that his name is not attached as the title does not diminish his work on the bill. And we also have to remember that the For the People Act is a very large act, and there are going to be pieces that may be married to the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act in conversation, but we've got to remember the two separate purposes. And I think it's remembering that and calling that out and calling attention to it, because the fundamental challenge is that we have to have a U.S. Senate that recognizes that nothing else passed will hold and nothing new will happen if we lose the right to participate in our elections in 22 and 24, because that's the path we're on. This is not hyperbolic. This is an actual crisis. And we have seen precursors of this in 2018 here in Georgia and around the country. We saw it in 2016, and we will see it on steroids in 2022 if we do not act.
The Texas Democrats who were in Washington, D.C., some of whom have actually contracted COVID while they were, for their trouble, that fight, that sort of demonstrating the will to fight, is that significant in your view, the activism that we're seeing? People are in the streets. I mean, this is going to be a summer of activism around voting, very clearly from lots of different groups. In the end, do you think that winds up moving votes and getting the 50? Or if not, what's the point of it? What's the purpose in the end?
The purpose of activism, the purpose of protest, is to signal to leaders the demands of the people for action. And so it is absolutely essential, especially when it's the leaders who are taking that step. Going from Texas to D.C. was not purely symbolic. It was an act of declaration that they need help, that we need help. The same help has to come from average citizens making those phone calls, from young people who transformed our elections, regardless of their race. Those young people changed the outcome of the future in the United States by participating at record rates, and they are also under attack. And so we have to remember that this call to action this summer, this hot call summer, is about making sure that this conversation about democracy doesn't get pushed aside as rhetorical. We have to see it as an urgent call to action, as urgent as anything we've ever seen. Because if you want to see action on police brutality, on climate change, on poverty, on women's reproductive choice, no matter what your issue is, if you don't have the right to vote and participate in elections, it is irrelevant.
Amen. One more time for the people in the back. If you guys care about all the other things, police reform, everything else you care about, if they lock you out of the voting booth, you get none of it. Just understand that. It's the most important right. It's what John Lewis fought and bled for. Stacey Abrams, you're the best. Thank you very much. Really appreciate everything that you're doing for this country and our democracy. All right, up next on The Readout, the first felony sentencing in the January 6th attack on our Capitol and what it could mean for the other insurrectionists. Stay right there.
Joy, congratulations on the one-year anniversary of your show. You are a truth teller and a voice for freedom, racial, and social justice. And I'm looking forward to joining you again on The Readout soon and watching more of those Leslie Jones, Joy Reid hype videos.
Yes, yes. What's up? Joy, down in my heart. Yes! 1 year anniversary! Happy anniversary, Joy! Love you! Love your show! Mwah, mwah.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
The hundreds of insurrection cases, which are still making their way through the courts, have provided some key insights into the kinds of people that made up Trump's MAGA army on January 6th. While all of them suffered from the mass delusion that is the big lie, some of them still seem to have some trouble telling fact from fiction. For instance, defendant Landon Copeland told the judge in his case last month, quote, "You're a robot to me. You can't come get me if I don't want you to." Another defendant, Pauline Bauer, is claiming she's a sovereign citizen, is therefore not subject to United States laws. She represented herself in court today and repeatedly interrupted the judge presiding over her case. But her latest court filing tells you everything you need to know. Here's an excerpt. Quote, "Now this, I, me, Pauline Bauer, the living soul, as one of we the people, hereby motion the court to drop all charges against my vessel, Pauline Bauer, and dismiss the case." I did not make that up. That's a direct quote. Yet, as we've seen, Donald Trump is holding these people up as model citizens, even patriots. In fact, about 100 of his supporters gathered for a demonstration outside the D.C. jail Saturday to protest the arrest and detention of the accused insurrectionists, who they say should be set free.
What you out here protesting today?
The injustice of the political prisoners of Joe Biden. We're here to help free the D.C. POB, prisoners of Biden.
A whole bunch of those people are guilty of what I, my phony legal term, aggravated tourism.
Was the insurrection real?
Nope.
It wasn't real?
No.
Aggravated tourism law, where you defecate all over the walls. Perfect. Meanwhile, defendant Paul Hodgkins became the first Capitol insurrectionist to be sentenced on felony charges today. After pleading guilty to one count of obstructing an official proceeding, he received 8 months in prison, far short of the 18 months that prosecutors had sought. Joining me now is Scott McFarland, NBC4 Washington investigative reporter, and Glenn Kirshner, federal former prosecutor and an MSNBC columnist. And Scott, I want to start with you. Give us the sort of readout from inside that courtroom, because I think for a lot of people, 8 months seems like a pretty light sentence. What did the judge say? What was the sort of explanation for what kind of sentence he received?
Well, the judge was ramping up, Joy, towards the sentencing, saying that what Hodgkins was part of January 6th was quite serious, forcing the evacuation of Congress from the Capitol. And the prosecutors pulled out this big bazooka saying that Hodgkins was part of a domestic terror incident. It was clear the judge was going to sentence Hodgkins to some prison time, but there he is going 10 months below what the federal prosecutors recommended. And the question is, Joy, what message does that send to the other defendants? That it's wise for them to step forward, say you're sorry, plead guilty, and seek leniency? Or does it show that if you challenge the prosecutors, sometimes the judge does not go along with what the prosecutors want?
It is stunning to me, Glenn, in a country where Hervis Rogers, a 60-something-year-old man, is facing decades behind bars for voting a couple of months before his parole ran out. Decades, like 20-something years in prison. While this person who participated in attacking our Capitol, in which the lynch mob chanted hang Mike Pence and brought a noose to do it with, somebody who participated in attacking our government gets 8 months in prison? Really?
You know, Joy, there are some pros and some cons regarding the way the Hodgkins case finished up. You know, the one pro is that he pleaded guilty to obstructing a congressional proceeding, and that proceeding was the certification of the results of the presidential election. Why that's so important is because this defendant did precisely what Donald Trump told him to do at Donald Trump's pep rally. He said, go down to the Capitol and stop. Donald Trump used the word steal, but he was signaling stop the certification of the election because there was no steal going on in the Capitol. This defendant now, Hodgkins, will now go to prison for doing precisely what Donald Trump told him to do. But there's a significant con here. The significant con is that the lowest guideline sentence this insurrectionist should have received was 15 months. 15 to 21 months is what the federal guideline said is the appropriate sentencing range. This judge inexplicably went 7 months lower, even though this is about as upsetting an obstruction of a congressional proceeding as we have ever seen. That, I predict, will inspire 500 plus other insurrectionists to say, maybe I should take my chances. Maybe I shouldn't plead guilty. Maybe I shouldn't cooperate and assist the prosecutors in going after other insurrectionists. Look at how lenient this judge just was on defendant Hodgkins. This sends the wrong message, in my estimation.
I feel like the message that's being sent overall, you know, to come back to you, Scott, is odd for a country that just, you know, experienced an American version of the beer market putsch. And you're now seeing this sort of what seems to me like a quite light sentence. We have of the apparently now House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy has picked his members of the January 6th Commission. And of the five people, the one, two, three, four, five people that he's put forward, three of them, Jim Banks, who's going to be the ranking member, Jim Jordan of Ohio, and a freshman named Representative Troy Nels, all voted to not certify the election, meaning they voted for the insurrection. They are insurrectionists and they're on the committee. I wonder if what is the mood sort of among those on Capitol Hill looking at these sentences and, you know, just in terms of your reporting, because it does feel like leniency is sort of going all around.
Well, we're not surprised to see Congressman Davis, who is the top Republican on the House Administration Committee, or Congressman Jordan, who also chairs a relevant committee, be part of this, to be the Republican selections. They have some type of jurisdiction here. But I talked to several members of Congress today who were asking me questions about the Hodgkin sentencing, and a couple things stood out. They asked me what struck you most about what Mr. Hodgkin said in court. A couple things. First of all, he made clear what he did was foolish, that it wasn't a politician's fault, that it was his fault. But then, Joy, he made explicit, in his words, that Joseph R. Biden Jr. is the rightful president of the United States. He felt empowered, or he felt it relevant to say that. I'm not sure what message that sends the other defendants. Will there be a queue of other defendants who have to say just that in seeking leniency? It's just a strange time,
yeah,
but that's reality.
If you were a prosecutor in this case, Glenn, would you feel like this was, in a sense, a failure in terms of the prosecution? Because it, to me, it is not sending a super strong message, as you sort of explained before, that the book not being thrown at somebody who was a part of an insurrection. And now the question becomes, if you're prosecuting the next guy that's coming down, it almost is like everyone should just plead out. You're only going to get 6-7 months. What's the big deal?
You know, Joy, I don't always want to just leap to the defense of prosecutors, my colleagues, my friends at the U.S. Attorney's Office. I don't see this, however, as a failure of the prosecutors because they pleaded him guilty to the most appropriate building block charge that they will now be able to use to work their way up the criminal ladder to the funders, the organizers, and the insiders. And most importantly, Joy, they were banking on the federal sentencing guidelines of 15 to 21 months. And they requested very reasonably and appropriately that Hodgkin's go to prison for a year and a half. They were banking on the very system that the judges ordinarily use to impose sentence. And when this judge, Judge Moss, went well below the lowest end of the guideline range, I think that was a shock to prosecutors.
Yeah.
I don't see this as a prosecutorial failure. I see it as a bit of a failure on the judge's part.
I think a lot of people who are watching this are going to agree with you on that. Scott McFarland, thank you very much. Keep us updated on the next cases. And Glenn Kirshner, always appreciate you as well. And up next, how can you trust a news network that deliberately puts the lives of its own viewers at risk? Tonight's Absolute Worst is straight ahead.
Congratulations on one hell of a year. And I look forward to many more years of your passion and your truth-telling as you try to save the Republic one fiery segment at a time.
My forever memory of your brilliant and contagious talent will be your shuffle from the set of The Readout to the Maddow-helmed, socially distanced anchor desk for the debates and the conventions and other big nights. How I enjoy watching you weave your reporting and your blunt analysis into bursts of brilliance from just a few feet away.
I just don't know where my life would be without you in it. I don't know where the viewers would be without you informing us. You have more than earned your seat at the primetime table, my friend. Happy anniversary, Joy. I love you more than words can say.
It was a time of pride for the gay community.
I felt like I was part of a movement to liberate ourselves.
Then came a mysterious and devastating disease.
The latest figures from Los Angeles County.
We were describing evidence of a new acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
This is a story of strength and resilience.
This is our deciding moment. Together, we are greater than AIDS.
Commitment to life. Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on MSNBC and streaming now on Peacock.
We spent spend a lot of time putting our health and even our lives into other people's hands. It's a matter of trust. We trust that those handling our food are washing their hands. We trust that airline pilots know what they're doing and they aren't high or drunk. Trust is a big part of how our economy works. In fact, it might be the key to making capitalism function. But what happens when we can no longer trust the people we need to in order to do commerce? Enter Mary Mallon, a professional cook who was born in Ireland in 1869. Mary emigrated to the U.S. and then found her way into the kitchens of New York's affluent families, including that of Charles Henry Warren, a New York banker who rented an Oyster Bay on the north coast of Long Island for the summer. One summer, people in the Warren household contracted typhoid fever. Now, this was a cause for alarm. Typhoid was associated with poor, unsanitary conditions, not the rich and famous playground of Oyster Bay, home to Theodore Roosevelt's summer White House. George Sober, a sanitary engineer, was hired to investigate and discovered the cause. It wasn't the area's freshwater clams, as he first thought. It was Mary Mallon, the cook who had worked for the wealthy Warren family weeks before the outbreak. He also found that seven families that she had cooked for had reported cases of typhoid fever as well, which had resulted in the infection of 22 people and the death of one girl. Mary Mallon would soon be known as the first asymptomatic carrier of the typhoid infection ever recorded, a carrier so deadly, in part due to a failure to properly wash her hands after going to the bathroom. Yuck. But also because despite being warned that she could be the carrier, she just kept right on cooking for other people. In 1907, about 3,000 New Yorkers had been infected by Salmonella typhi, with Mary seen as the main reason for the outbreak. Immunization and antibiotic treatment were not yet available, so it was Mr. Sober, that investigator, who convinced the New York Department of Health to take action. Either Mary had to stop cooking or try an experimental treatment to remove her gallbladder. Otherwise, she would have to be detained and isolated. Mary refused, even filing a lawsuit, insisting she was never sick. And that stubbornness is what turned Mary Mallon, in the popular culture, into the villain known as Typhoid Mary. It wasn't her illness that brought on her denunciation and the raw hatred that rained down upon her from mean cartoons and furious op-eds. It was her stubborn refusal to take any action whatsoever to stop making people sick. Eventually, Mary was transferred to Riverside Hospital in North Brother Island, where she was quarantined in this cottage. She would ultimately spend 26 years basically locked up. She was briefly released with a promise not to go back to cooking for rich families, but did so anyway under an assumed name, contaminating at least 25 doctors, nurses, and staff at Sloan Maternity Hospital in Manhattan, two of whom died. Mary Mallon died in 1938 after decades of forced lockdown. As the first known case of a healthy carrier in the United States, she was thought to be responsible for the contamination of at least 122 people, including five who died. And while there are huge ethical questions about the way that Typhoid Mary was treated by the state of New York, I mean, forced confinement, the idea that someone would deliberately risk other people's lives before we had workable vaccines remains a chilling prospect. Hashtag wash your hands. Typhoid Mary left behind a trail of death, but also scandal. Her ignorance or selfishness, whatever it was that allowed her to dismiss her threat to public safety. We're seeing a lot of that today. People who are refusing to take the simple action of getting a free vaccine or just wear masks to keep from sickening or even killing people with COVID. And so the people who are casting doubt and spreading mistruths by acting like modern day Typhoid Marys, I'm looking at you, Tuckums and Fox News, are tonight's absolute worst. And we'll talk more about that next.
Hey, Joy, congratulations on your first year of your show. You're doing a great job. We need you. You're doing a wonderful, wonderful job. Lots of love.
There's nothing better than seeing your face every day. So let's do it again and again and again for 50 years and more. I dare you. Love you, girl.
I have three things to say to you. First, congratulations on the one-year anniversary of the readout. Second, I love you. And third, keep pounding away at voting rights. and I love you. Oh. I know that's four, but I feel like I love you deserves a second mention.
Dr. Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, tells the Washington Post that America is in the midst of not one, but two pandemics or epidemics. A biological epidemic caused by a terrible virus, and the other is an epidemic of misinformation. On Friday, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the CDC, warned that this is becoming a pandemic of the unvaccinated. It should come as no surprise that many COVID cases are people who watch Fox News hosts and who downplayed the pandemic. According to Media Matters, between June 28th and July 11th, Fox personalities and guests made a total of 216 claims undermining or downplaying vaccines. Here's just a taste of the steady and unrelenting stream of lies.
Listen, if you didn't get a vaccination, that's your choice. And if you did, like I did and they did, and maybe you did, then you should not wear a mask. And if you didn't, if you want to go cliff diving this weekend, you don't have to check with me.
99% of the people who are dying from COVID are unvaccinated.
That's so their choice.
This has never, Sean, been about following the science. It's never been about following the facts and the truth. It's been about control from day one.
There's no reason right now, no clinical reason to go get vaccinated.
Wow. Their current argument is literally that people should have the right to kill themselves, just to own the libs. Thoughtful logic. But here's a nasty little secret. The corporate overlords over at Fox News have mandated vaccines for all of their employees who want to come to work. They've mandated vaccines for those who want to work there. And they've implemented even their own vaccine passport of sorts. All of this makes you wonder what the political advantage is of killing off supporters of Fox News, the GQP, and other right-wing outlets. Joining me now is Dr. Uche Blackstock, founder and CEO of Advancing Health Equity, and Tim Miller, writer-at-large for The Bulwark. And Dr. Blackstock, I have to say, I tweeted this weekend, I'll just say it again, you know, for, let's compartmentalize the Republicans for just a moment. I have a lot of friends who've got, you know, black cousins and uncles and friends who are also refusing to get vaccinated and who believe all of the conspiracy theories, that they will turn into a magnet, that they will become infertile. They believe all of it. And I tweeted this weekend, these people would never believe anything else that these MAGA people said. These MAGA people don't want you to vote. They don't want you to learn your history. They want to erase you from the history books and say slavery was like a picnic. They want to do, and, but when they tell you, you know, the people who think there's chicken poop ballot, you know, hidden, you know, there's ballots hidden in the chicken poop tell you you're going to turn into a magnet. Why are you suddenly believing them? Can you help us get to the bottom of why people of color are listening to these lies?
Yeah, well, thank you, Joy. And I did see that tweet. You know, what I will say is that people who have not been vaccinated, as you mentioned, have multiple reasons. It's safety issues. They're concerned about fertility, concerned about cost. There still are access issues that they're concerned about. But I think that they're traumatized. I think people of color, Black people in particular in this country, have been traumatized by racism. I think that even if you present us with facts, the clinical data from these trials saying that these vaccines are safe and effective, you know, these institutions have not been trustworthy towards us. So we have no reason to trust them. Add on the misinformation that is specifically being directed towards our communities. And it's being done so in a very insidious way. It's being characterized even as medical racism. So it's very hard for people to even distinguish that from actual facts. And I think that's the problem that we're seeing. Black communities, communities of color are specifically being targeted these days.
And they're being targeted in a lot of ways on Facebook. The same way, Tim Miller, there's a Venn diagram between the three groups of people who are being aggressively targeted, particularly using Facebook, to dissuade them from taking vaccines, and the people who were targeted in the last two presidential elections. It's the same three groups of people. And it's the same sort of weird conspiratorial hellhole of Russian-aided disinformation. But let's take the pin out of the Republicans for a moment. There's a couple of pieces of data. There's a YouGov economist poll that shows among unvaccinated people, 90% reject the vaccine for fear of side effects. 16% believe that the spread of COVID occurs among the unvaccinated. 1 in 5 believe the U.S. government is using vaccines to microchip the population. Another one, Gallup, shows that among Republicans, the faith in science itself has plummeted from 72% back in 1975 to just 45% now. On the Republican side, is it a matter of disinformation or is it a matter of pure politics?
Well, look, I think a little bit of both, Joy. I mean, David Frum was on the Bulwark podcast this morning, and he gave, a comparison that was really illustrative. He's up there in Canada. They get Facebook in Canada, too. You know, disinformation doesn't stop at the border, right? But Canada, who started vaccinating much after us because, you know, the companies there didn't do what Pfizer and the companies here did, obviously, so the U.S. got a head start. Canada has gone from behind us to now ahead of us in percent of the population vaccinated. Some of that is what you and the doctor are talking about marginalized communities and disinformation, of course. Obviously, we have a higher Black and Latino population here than in Canada. But a big part of that is these voters that you're talking about, the 20% that say that they think there's a microchip in the data. Those voters are being targeted specifically by Donald Trump, by Fox News and Newsmax and OAN. That is a unique to America problem.
That
they don't have in Canada. There's no Fox News in Canada, right?
They have conservative
politicians, right?
They
so
do.
That is the difference.
That is, but can I ask you this, just from your point of view as a conservative, why? What is in it for Fox to kill their own viewers? What would they get out of killing their own people? I don't get it.
This is bottom up, Joy. It's a ratings thing. At the very start, Fox didn't like Trump either. It's what the people watching demanded, right? And so if you're going to give the people what they want, if there is a conspiratorial strain running through conservatism, I think there is. If there is this don't tread on me strain that obviously goes through conservatism, Fox, rather than doing a responsible thing, leaders, rather than being responsible and saying, okay, I understand your concerns about that, but here's X, Y, and Z, the facts. Here's the truth. Here's why you have to get vaccinated. They're enabling it, right? So they're not thinking long-term about, is this person going to be alive to be in my ratings in 2040? They're thinking about the ratings today.
Yeah.
And the person that's doing the best is the person who's driving the most disinformation, Tucker.
Who's vaccinated. He won't admit it, but they're all vaccinated. They're required to be vaccinated to work there. They are the strictest of all the cable companies in terms of making them get vaccinated. Trust and believe. All the Fox people don't watch this, but if you did, if somebody sends it to you, all those people who are telling you not to get vaccinated are vaccinated. All of them. Dr. Blackstock, let's go to this one. Geraldo, who I don't usually agree with, said something I think is very true. He tweeted, you know, hearing crazy talk on cable TV right now about folks having the constitutional right not to get vaccinated. He's like, that's true. They may be dopey, but they do have that right. That's true. We too have rights to deny the unvaccinated access to our home, school, or business. Is the way to get people to get vaccinated the way that France did it? Said, fine, you don't want to get vaccinated, you can't go to public events, you can't get on a cruise, you can't come to this business, you can't come to the party. Is that the way to do it in your view?
You know what? I think so. I think the Biden administration has not wanted to wade into those legal waters, but I think they need to put the pressure on employers, on healthcare facilities to mandate vaccines. And we actually know when we survey the unvaccinated, there is a significant proportion of them who say they will take the vaccine if it's mandated by their employer or if it influences whether or not they're able to go to a sporting event or on a flight. And so we know that's going to make a difference. And so no pun intended, but I think vaccine mandates are going to move the needle for us.
And you know who's doing that, but you know what we know it's true? Because Fox is doing it! Because Fox is literally doing that exact thing. You can't work there unless your behind is vaccinated. And Fox, I'm going to leave it there. Dr. Uche Blackstock and Tim Miller, thank you both very much. Very much. I hope you all get vaccinated. Up next, Women March for Justice in our nation's capital. We'll be right back.
Joy, congratulations on 1 year. You are doing such important work at such an important time. And best of luck to you on the road ahead.
Cool.
During these challenging times, you have been a strong, direct, and reassuring voice, helping Americans stay safe and informed. And you have inspired so many, particularly young women of color, who see your success as opening the doors of opportunity. Congratulations again to you and your team.
Hello, everyone. Happy 1 year anniversary to my friend Joy Reid and the Readout. I'm so proud of you, Joy. Congratulations.
I am here carrying the torch for so many women that have come before us.
We are building the movement that will give our children and the next generations the life that they deserve.
In this time, when our voting rights are under attack, and economic justice is being denied, we must, and so we are, calling out the immoral obstructionism of Congress.
173 years ago today, in Seneca Falls, New York. A group of women held a convention that was the catalyst for the women's rights movement, particularly the right to vote. Today, a far more diverse group of women marched from the Supreme Court to the United States Capitol to demand an end to the filibuster, passage of the For the People Act, a restoration of the Voting Rights Act, and an increase in the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. According to the Poor People's Campaign, which organized the march, about 100 women were arrested once they reached the Capitol. One of those arrested, the co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, the Reverend Liz Theo Harris, joins me now. She's also the director of the Cairo Center for Religious Rights and Social Justice at Union Theological Seminary, along with Aaron Haynes, the editor-at-large of the 19th. Thank you both for being here. And Reverend Theo Harris, let me start with you. You were arrested today marching not just for voting rights. Talk about why that you made it a broader spectrum to include the minimum wage.
Well, we're living today in a nation that is the richest nation in the world, and yet 140 million people, 70 million women are poor or one emergency away. And so we want to connect the attack, the very dire attack on voting rights right now, with larger issues of racial and economic justice. And so our demands are four. One is to end the filibuster. Two is to pass all the provisions of the For the People Act. Three is to restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And four is to raise the minimum wage to a $15 an hour wage immediately. And we are calling for this to happen by August 6th, which is the 56th anniversary of the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And yet we have fewer voting rights today that impacts poor and low-income people by far the most, women, poor women of color the most in this day and age. And it doesn't have to be this way. And so we're organizing and mobilizing to make a change.
You know, and Aaron, it strikes me that, you know, from the Seneca Falls, convention all the way to the passage of the right of women, at least white women, to vote in this country was all the way from 1848 to 1919. And so the sort of idea that it's going to take years and years of activism to restore something that a lot of people thought was passed in 1965 seems rather depressing. What do you make of the fact that it's back to the streets because nothing seems to be happening in the suites of Washington?
Well, listen, absolutely. My jam, Joy. I want to talk about this. We have a newsroom that is named for the 19th Amendment, but with an asterisk, because we know that it was white women who got the right to vote when the 19th Amendment was ratified 100 years ago last year. But look, that was a long fight for those white women to get their right to vote, but it was an even longer fight for marginalized women, women of color, who would have to wait until the Voting Rights Act of 1965, until their voting rights were expanded. And frankly, their voting rights have been fragile since then. Even they have had to defend their right to vote, even in the wake of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And those rights are more fragile than ever before. And so you see women continuing to operate with a sense of urgency, willing to put it all on the line, willing to get arrested, as Reverend Theo Harris and dozens of other women were arrested today. You've had other women, being arrested, women of color being arrested in recent weeks, because they are trying to keep the spotlight on this issue. They know that women, the majority of the electorate, frankly, their voting rights are uncertain now, even as we know that they voted in this last election, and they are seeing those voting rights being threatened as a result of that in many ways. And Reverend Theo Harris is exactly right. These issues are related. The people who voted in record numbers, the women who voted in record numbers, were voting for change, were voting for, into poverty. We're voting for a different life for themselves, for their families. And so, you know, if the right to vote is in jeopardy for them, then all of the things that they want to see happen, all of the issues which are women's issues, are under threat if the right to vote is under threat.
You know, and to that very point, Reverend Theo Harris, I mean, you know, women are the majority of low wage workers, the majority of, sort of working class workers are suffering all of these sort of pandemics, social pandemics, all at the same time. What is the significance of having women leading this movement?
Well, I think when we look at change in history, when we look at transformative missions, at transformative movements, it's always those that are most impacted by the injustice that need to and do take the lead in abolishing that injustice, not just for them, but for the whole society. And I think that is exactly what's happening today when when a multiracial fusion group of women from 35 states across the country, from dozens of partner organizations, put themselves out there, are willing to risk arrest, making sure that we see the connections between the fact that you're exactly right, that the vast majority of the people that we're now calling essential workers, but who are still not being paid enough to afford all the essentials of life, are women, and especially poor women of color. And folks have caring burdens, education burdens, and we're already dealing with the pandemics of racism, the pandemics of poverty that preceded this COVID pandemic, and have all the more to deal with now, and are leading the way into a transformative movement for change for everyone.
And let me ask you, Aaron, about sort of the kind of strategery. This is Amy Klobuchar, very quickly. She was on the Sunday show talking about what she called election infrastructure. Take a listen.
We have the infrastructure packages, the Build Back Better packages. The second one will most likely, of course, be a Democratic package through another process called reconciliation. We can also put election infrastructure funding along with housing and childcare and the like, and do what we can to incentivize mail-in balloting. That is no substitution for the For the People Act, John Lewis Act, but it's just another vehicle where I can push these provisions.
Are you hearing anything about that, talking with people on Capitol Hill, Aaron, this idea of doing election infrastructure and maybe pushing that through with the reconciliation infrastructure bill?
Well, Joy, I think you're increasingly hearing voting rights as being framed as part of this country's infrastructure, as part of democracy's infrastructure. And frankly, if voting rights is not secure, then our democracy is less stable. And so those are the terms that you're now hearing that framed in. Obviously, you know, this administration has been working to kind of redefine what infrastructure can mean for this country. Senator Klobuchar down there making the case in my hometown of Atlanta today at the National Civil and Human Rights Center, having, that rare field hearing, the first in two decades, to try to lay out the case for why voting is such an important part of this country's infrastructure. So I think that that's probably a drumbeat and messaging that we're going to continue to hear from Democrats.
I am certainly sure of that. Reverend Liz Theo Harris, Aaron Haynes, thank you both very much. And by the way, for those of you who are staying up late, I will be a guest tonight on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, which is very cool. That is all for the readout tonight.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.